welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Ledman. Peripatetic world traveler Ellen Brown is back today on the program. It's been much too long, so it's great to have Ellen back on again. She's been globetrotting, maybe that's a good expression, globetrotting, and giving talks on, I'm sure, what she knows best, public banking. And she's been doing a little bit of writing. She wrote about public banking in Scotland. She was there. She has an article not yet written. It's one I've got an article all written. Ellen, I think, is still working on hers. Mine has been done for a few days now. I haven't been able to get it out because other stuff that is so time-sensitive, I've had to get it out right away. And I'm talking about the so-called fiscal cliff, malarkey. I call it double-speak duplicity. You know, the debt is real. The way they're attacking it is an absolute hoax. Anyway, Ellen, you've got some interesting things in the article you're still working on. Dare I mention one? I mean, they all caught my eye. Well, a $1 trillion coin. Try putting that one in your pocket and walking down the street without checking whether there's a hole in your pocket. If somebody picked it up, they wouldn't know what the hell it was or what to do with it. What to do with it? My God, where could you cash a $1 trillion coin?
Yeah, well, it would be difficult to make change for, but that's the thing. You can just put it in the Treasury's account with the Federal Reserve, and then you can write checks on it.
Oh, indeed, you sure can do that. Or go to any of your local Federal Reserve banks, and if you don't have one, you can probably hire a couple of armed guards, considering how rich you are, and have them personally deliver it to the Fed bank closest to where you live. I happen to have one downtown in Chicago, so if I ever get a $1 trillion coin, Ellen, I could just hop on a bus, the hell a bus, a little limousine, and head on down to my Fed bank and say I need a private consultancy if you don't mind.
Right. Well, it sounds off the wall, and it was off. I actually brought that up in 2007. I saw these whole articles on who first originated this idea, and different people were claiming credit. Of course, I don't claim credit either. It was somebody in the 1980s from the U.S. Mint said that the Constitution says Congress shall have the power to coin money and regulate the value thereof, and it doesn't say what value they put on, they need to put on the coins, so they could do a few $1 trillion coins. And different people, there was a law professor from Yale who confirmed that this was legal, and number of authorities have looked at it and said it's a good idea. And even people like Paul Krugman said, well, it's been called a legal trick or whatever, but the whole debt crisis is a legal trick. There are two competing statutes, a statute competing with the Constitution. The 14th Amendment says that Congress is required to pay its bills when in full and on time, and they can't tell what the bills are going to be. I mean, they can't tell if they're going to have the money, if they're going to have enough in the way of taxes to pay off the budget until the end of the year, but they make the budget at the beginning of the year. So they're bound to go over sometimes, particularly in these trying times when people aren't paying taxes because they don't have jobs. So they have to pay the debt. That's in the Constitution. So what are they going to do? So this statute that was passed in 1917 about the debt ceiling, and then every few years they change it because they keep lifting the debt ceiling. So it's clearly bogus, and it's clearly unconstitutional relative to the 14th Amendment. So you need some sort of legal trick or whatever. You need to fight fire with fire. So they've come up with their bogus argument for why they can block Congress from passing its budget. So we need to pull out our Trump card.
Well, that is quite a Trump card. Quite
beat
a Trump card. Ellen, if I ever get myself one of those little items, I will hire a private 747, and I will come on out and join you, and we'll head off for some warm place.
Right.
And talk about public banking. What else? Oh my goodness! Well, one of your other gems in the article was declare the national debt illegal. Well, now that would be a neat trick if you could. I suppose you could revoke the 14th Amendment. Was that the right one, the 14th Amendment?
No, I meant to declare the debt ceiling illegal.
The debt ceiling. The debt.
Because it contradicts the 14th Amendment.
It contradicts the 14th Amendment.
You could also, among many solutions that have actually been proposed, not by me, or, they've been proposed by me, but other people have proposed them too, is to just pay off the debt through the Federal Reserve. And in fact, they're doing it right now. The QE4 is, they just added $45 billion monthly to the QE3, which will bring it to $85 billion monthly, and the $45 billion is to go to purchase government bonds. So when the Fed purchases them, they rebate their profits to the government, so it's effectively interest-free. So if the Fed could purchase the whole debt, and it would save $500 billion a year, which is what we pay in interest on the federal debt. I think it was Ron Paul that recommended that the Fed, at that point, it was like a year ago, the Fed had $1.7 trillion in federal securities, and Ron Paul said, well, just have the Fed rip up their $1.7 trillion, because it's all bogus anyway. I mean, you're talking about the government owing money to the Federal Reserve, which bought the securities with money created on their books. So why not just call it a wash, because the Treasury could just as well create the money on its books or print a few coins. It appears to me that the whole thing is sleight of hand in order to make it not be obvious that our money is created somewhere just on the books of a bank.
And of course it's created by private bankers for their own self-interest at the expense of everybody else. My best idea, and yours too, Ellen, is to take that Federal Reserve and make it really federal. Deprivatize it and make it a real, give it any name that you want, but make it really federal. Put money back in the hands where it belongs. Get it out of the hands of Wall Street, the banking predators, so they can literally steal. The idea is that, you do all these shenanigans, and the idea is to take it out of our hide, make us pay for it either right away or future generations. And it gets worse and worse, so they keep piling up this debt. They keep printing more money. They keep piling it on to the people who shouldn't be getting any of it. I mean, they should be paying it back, not getting more. And this dirty game goes on and on. And you'll never fix the problem unless you can put banking back in public hands, real public banking on a national scale.
Mm-hmm. Well, another idea that I want to overlook was Simon Thorpe is a French blogger. When I was in Switzerland, I actually met him. He came to Switzerland, and he has looked at the numbers for a financial transaction tax. According to the Bank for International Settlements, there's three quadrillion, that's 3,000 trillion. Is that right? 3,000 trillion?
Sounds right.
In financial transactions every year in the U.S. So, and he added other things, the DTCC, which is the agency that handles all the, stock trades and so forth. And he came up to close to 4.5 quadrillion. So if you put, just take the 3 quadrillion and you imposed a 0.05% tax, in other words, 1/20th of 1%, like almost nothing. You wouldn't feel it at all if you were selling an ordinary stock once a month or whatever, like people do. If you imposed that on all financial trades, you would come up with $1.5 trillion a year, enough to eliminate income taxes with some despair, or what I would recommend is keep the income taxes, and then you've got $3 trillion, so you've got plenty of money to take care of your people. You can do a real nice Social Security, nice Medicare for all, and everything else we need. Rehire all those teachers and put some extra teachers on. Give them a decent salary.
Well, the truth, as you understand it very well, Ellen, there's plenty of money to do responsible things if you stop doing the irresponsible ones. Other things that go along with what you're saying. Reinstate a progressive tax system. People who earn more should pay more. People who earn less should pay less and at lower rates. People who earn below a certain minimum amount that you need just to basically live and pay the rent and buy food and take care of medical care and so on, people who earn that kind of an income, and it's far higher than the official poverty income level for a family of four, which is still around $22,500. My God, you can't live a family of four in downtown Chicago. You can't live on double that amount, let alone $22,500. My God, rent alone. Well, rent. I don't know if that amount of money would cover your rent and your food for a family of four. Let's say it would cover that. It wouldn't cover very much more. So that's the kind of situation you're in. You need to get these people out from under the tax burden, and it's a lot more than the income tax. I mean, you pay Illinois and Chicago combined have a huge sales tax, about 10% combined. I mean, that is just grand larceny. Why should these people pay? I mean, they and millionaires pay the same tax. You've got all kinds of other local taxes. Of course, you've got property taxes. They're very onerous. You can have people who bought a home many years ago when it was very, very cheap, and they're not rich, and now they're retired, and they're living in their home, and they're paying a very, very burdensome property tax. I mean, mine is extraordinarily expensive, and I bought my condominium over 40 years ago. Well, just about 40 years ago, and it was dirt cheap compared to what it is now, and the property taxes were dirt cheap compared to what they were now, but they keep going up all the time. We can have any kind of an economic environment. We can have inflation. We can have deflation. They're going to keep hiking those taxes all the time. They do it a little bit more, a little bit less each year, but it just goes up incrementally. It's a great burden on people who really don't have the wherewithal to handle this stuff. You were talking about a Tobin tax, Ellen. I actually go along with that, and the idea of that would be to hit the speculators, people who buy stocks and sell them a year later or 5 years later. The idea isn't to hit them. They're mostly small people, or they do it for their IRAs or their small investment accounts, whatever they're doing. But it's the speculators that are in and out five times a day, whatever the heck they do. They're the ones who should pay a price. They're playing fast and loose. The big Wall Street firms, they've got the markets rigged and manipulated. You wrote about it. So did I. We talked about it a little bit yesterday on the program. It's a dirty scheme. They can do whatever they want, and to pay a minuscule tax, my God, it's the enormous amount of money you could collect, Ellen. You mentioned numbers. I have no idea what they are, but they're huge. And the other big one for me, besides the ones mentioned so far, is the U.S. military. The U.S. military spends more than double the official amount, which is the National Defense Authorization Act, annually. It's more than double that amount because there are so many other categories related to defense, including homeland defense, homeland security, interest on the debt. It services the military portion of it, veterans benefits, all sorts of things related to the military, the black budgets for intelligence, the supplemental add-ons. It goes on and on and on, and my guess is minimally $1.5 trillion a year spent on defense, national, overseas. It shouldn't be more than 20% of that. And the amount spent is more than the rest of the world combined. And America has no enemies except the ones it invents. So stop these wars. Stop inventing enemies. Close the overseas bases. Bring home the forces. End all of these wars and close the Homeland Security Department. It's the National Gestapo. We didn't need it before. We certainly don't need it now. They commit crimes. They certainly don't protect us. They protect the big boys. They don't protect the people. Ellen, I could keep this going for the rest of the hour, but you jump in.
Yeah, I agree with all that. Well, and the irony of it is that the whole debt ceiling crisis, apparently the goal was to take down Social Security and Medicare, as they've been trying to do for decades, ever since Roosevelt put them in, I think. And what's liable to happen since the Democrats won is that taxes will get raised on the rich, but they're not going to get their, they're not going to gut the entitlements. Hopefully they're not. So they could just get, that's why I called it, called my article, Be Careful What You Ask For. They could just get the downside without the upside of what they're aiming for.
Well,
which,
I absolutely,
you know,
agree
which is all right with me, but
I've written about
that. But it's
still
not going to solve the problem without some of these other more radical solutions.
Oh, that's right. Well, they want to keep these wars going. They want to keep the trillions of dollars handed to corporate crooks. The bank is not the only corporate crooks getting this money. All the corporate crooks get it. Every one of them is a corporate crook. And they all get these massive handouts. They call it subsidies. They give it any name they want to give it. But there are tax dollars. Hundreds of billions of dollars go to these people. And they want to keep handing that money to them. They want to keep waging imperial wars. So where are they going to get the money? They're going to destroy America's social safety net, and they want to go after the big ticket items. Most of all, you named them, Ellen. Medicare. Medicare was Lyndon Johnson and Medicaid. Roosevelt,
right.
Social Security. I don't think Truman did any. He just talked about all the good things that Roosevelt did. He had a fair, Roosevelt had a New Deal. Truman had a fair deal, which was just mouthing off for a number of years before Eisenhower replaced him. I just wrote about what it was. I mean, Truman had a lot of crimes in his resume. I just wrote about one on an article I wrote about yesterday when Michigan passed a right to work law. And I reviewed the Taft-Hartley law and the provision in Taft-Hartley that gives states the right to opt out of unions if they want to. They don't ban unions, but it gives the states to opt out by these right to work laws. I mean, they just crush working people. But Truman voted against Taft-Hartley. Taft-Hartley also lets the government, end the strike on national security or any other grounds, end the strike for 80 days. Truman called the Taft-Hartley law a slave labor bill, and to this day, he is the only president who used it more times than any other president, certainly not before him, the law didn't exist, but any president after him, including Reagan, including George Bush, either Bush, including Obama, including Clinton, Harry Truman, he used it 10 times as a strikebreaker for business. Anyway, that's another issue. But,
it is shocking what happened in Michigan. I mean, that was I grew up in Michigan, and my dad was an auto worker at one time, and my grandfather, until he got laid off during the Depression, and they had no money at all. But that's partly what motivates me. I think my whole deceased family is hovering around saying, you get that book written.
Well, Michigan, I think at one time was the most unionized state in the nation. And now it's heading for one of the least unionized states.
Unbelievable. How did they break them? I haven't looked closely, but I was shocked to see that.
Well, you know, it doesn't really matter whether it's a Republican or a Democrat governor. Ellen, they have a Republican governor, but the Democrat governors are just as bad. I mean, you know what Jerry Brown is doing in California. He wants no part of a public banking bill. I mean, you know that. So, I mean, these guys are scam artists. They're on the side of business just the way the Republicans are. There's no difference. So a guy named Rick Schneider in Illinois, in Michigan, signed this right-to-work law. It's really outrageous. It basically says unions, you have no rights. Workers, you have no rights. And the union bosses go along with this stuff, which is long-standing policy. I mean, it goes back so many years. At one time, union bosses did something for their rank and file, but beginning with the 1980s, Lane Kirkland, he was the guy who allied with Ronald Reagan to instigate the crackdown on the PATCO strikers, the air traffic controllers. That was 30 years ago. And organized labor never looked back. It was straight downhill to oblivion after that. Public workers are a shadow of what they were, from 35% organized in the 1950s to less than 7% today. A lot of public workers organized, but the war is now raging against them. And these right to work laws and all the other stuff, the stuff that went on in Wisconsin in 2011 with a terrible bill that was ruled unconstitutional by the state Supreme Court. So it's still in flux, a lot of provisions in it. I'm sure they're going to manipulate it. maybe rewrite the stuff the court didn't like and come back and really enforce the same kind of stuff that's on the books right now. So we'll see where that goes. I wrote about it recently. But, I mean, they just want to destroy the rights of people. They want to destroy their benefits. They want to get rid of public pensions. I mean, they really want to turn America into Guatemala in the worst sense. And that's a phrase I've used a number of times, and I don't say it lightly, Ellen. So you could call it the Guatemala bill. The fiscal cliff, which is really the Guatemala debate. Both parties agree. They want America to be Guatemala. They're just working out the fine print right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's why it seems to me we might be ripe for a revolution of some sort. I mean, hopefully a peaceful revolution, but I could certainly see a populist movement that together, if we actually got organized and got strong enough, we would be bigger than they are. But that's what I work on all the time, you know, try to get all that. Now we're doing a public banking coalition where we're trying to get other groups aligned. But the trouble is you have all these groups that are trying to change things, but they all sort of see the others with suspicion. So I know I was in the alternative healthcare movement for a long time, and it was the same way, where you have all these sort of mavericks who are brilliant in their way, but they all think all the other mavericks are quacks. So they would all tear each other down instead of getting organized and getting together. So they could never, meanwhile, the doctors were marching in lockstep because they had all been brainwashed in the same schools. They all agreed with each other. They all wouldn't testify against each other in court, et cetera. So they had this solid front. I think it's just a problem with public or with populist movements is they're basically leaderless, and so you have to figure out some way to get everybody together, like on the same page, without having a leader that other people resent or that winds up getting shot, like Martin Luther King. So it's a difficult thing to do, but it's certainly been done historically.
Can I interject one thing, Ellen? I just got an email from a father whose son I wrote about a good many months ago. I believe I'd have to go back. I think I wrote about him twice, and I'd have to go back and review the details. So it's been a couple of years since I wrote about it, but I believe this was a Canadian youth who was framed on charges he had nothing whatsoever to do with. And his father is an academic, a PhD. He does scholarly writing. He just sent me an email. Can I just read this?
Yeah, go ahead.
He says, "Dear Steve, hope this message finds you in good health and doing all well. Yesterday, the Supreme Court, I think he means the Supreme Court of Canada, decided the fate of my son, Momin. The final appeal was heard in June, and we were hopeful of a favorable outcome. However, the Supreme Court justices authenticated the previous provincial appeal verdict of life sentence to Momin.
Wow.
A young boy, not a boy, a young man, I think in his 20s. He did absolutely nothing. A Muslim, he was targeted for his faith. Again, absolutely innocent of all charges. And they're going to keep him in prison for life." He goes on to say, "Please recall that the trial judge had given him 10.5 years. 10.5 years in total for thought crimes or crimes he did not commit in early 2009. The provincial judge is on appeal. Without hearing the evidence of facts of the case, increased it to a life sentence. Now the Supreme Court judges did ask many questions and had expressed some concerns on the rationality of life sentence being without a crime or charge. Yet in the final verdict, they kept the same unfair sentence. We were expecting a fair and honest judgment. Along with my family, we are devastated, and it was the most unexpected outcome." This man's name is Mahbub. I literally just got this email 2 or 3 minutes ago.
What was the charge? What did he allegedly do?
I'd have to go back and review. I think there were no real charges. There were just accusations of conspiracy or something related to what they think he might have been involved with. But there was no evidence connecting them to anything. How do you give a guy 2 minutes in prison without evidence to convict him? How do you give him life in prison? with no evidence. And it's as bad in Canada as it is in America. And I read this because I've communicated with this man. I wrote about his son. This issue was one of my major ones, Ellen. It's not what we're discussing now. But it's so important because U.S. prisons are rotting with absolutely innocent people. They're political prisoners. There are tens of thousands of them there. They're there for different reasons. So many of them Muslims or activists of different types or blacks or Latinos. And they're all innocent. They didn't commit any crimes. And it's true in Canada as well. I wrote about another man, a man who appears in this program, a professor who got sacked from the University of Ottawa, Denny Rancourt. He's been on this program a few times. He'll be back the end of the month. He was sacked for supporting Palestinian rights. Can you imagine that? I mean, he was a world figure in his field, physics. He was also a very distinguished environmental scientist, and they sacked him for supporting Palestinian rights. They didn't say that, of course. They cited other reasons. But his students loved him. His teaching technique was marvelous. The kids absolutely loved being in his class, and they fired him because they said his teaching methods weren't good. Well, this is the kind of stuff that goes on. So whether they're doing this to people like you, me, or whoever, they're doing it in so many other ways, Ellen, like what you wrote about, the financial ripoffs and the fiscal cliff debate and all the rest of it, and the wars that aren't fought to defend us, they're fought to harm us, and all of the terrible harm, and the police state laws that go on the books that harm so many people. I mean, it's no exaggeration to say that America is literally a thin hair's breadth from full-blown tyranny. So whether they steal their money or our freedom or whatever, they're stealing everything about us they can get their hands on. Very sad, Ellen. Let's go back to the fiscal stuff.
It's a little easier to tackle, yeah. Well, and then the question is, what do we do about it? So that's what I'm saying. We need a populist movement, and we need strength, and we need to see eye to eye on things. And so that's the hard thing for me, is framing a message that doesn't offend anyone, that everybody can get on board with, and just to make, you know, to make an inroad, and then we can make that little inroad bigger and bigger. But that public banking definitely strikes a chord, and that's what we're working on. Of course, I went to Malaysia for a conference, and then because I was flying over Europe, I stopped in Switzerland to see my daughter.
You parachuted in for a short stay.
So then I was contacted by this man in Scotland who wanted me to give a presentation in Scotland, because they're actually considering a public bank, because they're considering independence in 2014. It's the Scottish Nationalist Party, which has been pushing for independence from the UK since the 1930s, since they were formed as a political party, but they finally won an election, which nobody expected. So now they're talking about independence in 2014, and to go along with that, they would need financial independence, and a public bank would help a great deal. So what was interesting to me was that they actually had figures that I could put our theories onto. So the idea was to take the Scottish Investment Bank, which is already publicly owned, and it gets £25 million pounds from the government. So that could be the capital base for a depository bank on the model of the Bank of North Dakota. So the $25 million could back $250 million in loans, and then you need deposits to cover that. But you could get $125 million just from the government. It's the government of Scotland itself, if you put all the deposits in the bank the way Bank of North Dakota does, mandate that they all go in the bank. And then you could get another $125 million from the local governments, and that would only be 14% of the potential available among the local governments. So the local governments have a lot more in the way of deposits than the national government. So if you add all those up, you could have seven times that much in local government deposits. But anyway, it would be easy to come up with the $250 million. Wait, am I saying that right? Yeah, to cover the $25 million capital base, or the $250 million in loans that you could then issue, so that they could use those loans to get all their businesses going. So So it was a quite viable business model, and it, we had a really interesting discussion afterwards. But then, because I was flying over the East Coast, it was somebody wanted a we have a public banking group in Washington, D.C., and they wanted a presentation. So I stopped there. And then, because we were there, it was also Mark Armstrong, who's executive director of the Public Banking Institute. So we went to Pennsylvania, where they were also have things happening. It's a, they're talking about a county-owned bank, and then we did a, so we did a presentation there, and then we went to Maine and to Vermont, and all those places they're really actively pursuing this idea. So it definitely gets a lot of traction. I mean, it's sort of a no-brainer. Here's how I've struggled to make the message something that's understandable, because, you know, the whole banking thing is so ununderstandable, and people just shudder at the thought. They just don't really even want to think about all that complicated stuff. But it seems to me what is very simple and very is a no-brainer is that 40% of everything we buy goes to interest, 40% of public projects goes to interest, and of course that interest is now goes to Wall Street, and along with the interest that we you get the fees for the their investment advisors and the credit default swaps and the insurance rate swaps that have bankrupted a lot of small cities and counties. So you have all this sort of financial products that you have to pay for in Wall Street. So you could save all that. You could save 40% of the cost of public projects by funding it through your own bank. And on top of that, you don't have to get caught in these interest rate swaps, and you don't have to worry about your credit rating. You've always got a credit line with the bank. And the state has a credit line with the bank. In North Dakota, when they went over budget, they just tapped up their credit line with the Bank of North Dakota, and the next year they were back on track. So they don't have to keep these huge rainy day funds like everybody else keeps, and that are all separate, and they can't use that money for anything. It's just sitting there because they don't have a credit line like the banks have with each other. They have credit lines with each other for 0.25%. In other words, they can borrow for almost for free. So if you have your own bank, you too can borrow almost for free. So that's my opening pitch these days.
Well, indeed so. It really is not rocket science to do things right. But somehow, the right way is avoided. It's been avoided for a long time. It gets worse and worse and worse. And the people who are literally ripping off the system get greater license to rip off even more. And you're right, Ellen. The only way to change things, I say it all the time in this program, it's up to popular sentiment to change these terrible things going on. And they never, ever will change any other way. They cannot be changed through the ballot box. The ballot box is worthless. I'm all for a revolution. I want a nonviolent one. But without some kind of revolutionary act committed, sustained, it's going to get worse and worse and worse. That's what's been happening. That's what's happening now. Guaranteed. I wish I could put money on it. I'm not a betting man, but that's a sure thing. Anyway, let's take a quick break and we'll come right back. Welcome back. On with Ellen Brown. Talking about a lot of things, mainly the fiscal issues, the fiscal cliff, the ripoff we're getting, the things we could do right that we're not doing. Ellen, I don't know if you remember precisely where you left off, but if you do, or you want to pick up a new train of thought, let me put it that way, let me let you pick off what we were talking about before the break.
Well, I'll just add one more thing. You sometimes hear bankers say, well, we recycle the interest too, that, you know, we spend like everybody else, and so so the profits from banking go back into the economy. But there was some recent data that 21 to 32 trillion is now stashed in offshore tax havens. And this is money that's mostly Wall Street money, and it's just growing like a parasite on the side of the economy. So that money does not go back into the economy. I mean, if it does, it's like a fishing line. You put out a minnow and you take back a trout. They put out 10 and take back 11. You know, they're always, it's money that grows. It's always a loan or an investment with more coming back than goes out. So it's just this parasite sucking the vitality out of the economy. And if you could get the parasite off there, get your parasite medicine going, then we could have it all. It seems to me that's what's holding us down. It's the old thing about we've got the workers and we've got the materials. Why can't they get together and make the stuff we need? Because we don't have the money. But what is the money? It's just a means of getting those things together. And it's being turned off artificially. There's a tourniquet on the flow of credit. This is an idea of my daughter, but it resonated really well. That people always say, "Well, public banks, that's socialism for the government to own the bank." But she's got a master's in economics, and there are certain things that belong in the public sector and certain things that belong in the private sector in a capitalist economy as well as a socialist economy, and those are the things that belong in the public sector are infrastructure, the things that everybody shares, the things that makes the economy run. And it's obvious that banking is infrastructure because we bailed out the banks. Why don't we just let them go bankrupt like any other business? It's because we all know that we're hooked into that system, and that if they collapse, our money goes with it. Our money is just numbers on a screen, and if the screen turns off, our money goes with it. So if you look at it as financial infrastructure, then it properly belongs in the public sector.
Well, it really does belong in the public sector. And the only kind of government I'm in favor of, and I know you too, Ellen, is the one that works best responsibly for everybody in the country. That's called good government, and government that only serves a small segment of society, the segment that needs the government least, and the much larger segment that needs the government most, they get left out of the cold. You can give it any name that you want, but that's bad governance, and nobody should support that, and we sure have that in America. We always had it in America, but sometimes it wasn't as bad as it is now, and I honestly believe it's worse now than it ever was. I mean, there were horrible things that went on in the past. I mean the 19th century massacres and slavery and all the rest. I mean that was just an abomination, but things change but stay the same. So, you know, we got rid of chattel slavery, now we have wage slavery. We got civil rights and now they're all gone, and things are worse now than they were on the Jim Crow. I mean, that's how bad America is. The laws on the books that keep getting passed, and more of them, and Obama contributed his share along with George Bush's. I mean, literally, police state laws, that's what they are. I've written about them. I've written exactly what they say, you know, the key stuff in these laws. There's no other way to interpret them but to call them police state laws, the kind of stuff that you had in Nazi Germany, in fascist Italy, in other countries that are governed the same way. And it goes on and on. And, of course, our wealth is being stolen. Our futures are being stolen. Nobody cares. They want to take food stamps away from families who may not be able to feed themselves or their kids without these food stamps. There'll be cuts in food stamps in the so-called grand bargain that's going to be coming out. They're going to do it incrementally. My article gives a little bit of a timeline where my guess is they they'll get a little bit done before the end of the year. We've only got a couple of weeks left. I don't know whether these guys want to take a break at Christmas time, but, you know, they'll do what they want to do. I mean, they can decide 2 minutes before midnight on New Year's Eve and call it a done deal. But I think what they'll probably do is do something effective right away, just to say they got something done. And then they'll use the hokum of continuing resolutions, Ellen. You know, they'll kick the can down the road for 2 months. 3 months, mm-hmm. and they'll keep debating, keep discussing, keep doing whatever they're doing. I think they're in a back room someplace playing pinochle or poker or something, and they call it negotiating. But anyway, they'll keep that scheme going for a while, and then when they finally come up with a package, whenever that is, there'll be some upfront, and I think most of it will be backloaded. So just like boiling a frog, if you just get served to dinner on the day of the announcement, I mean, there really would be public rage. But if you kill people, you know, death by a thousand strokes, Ellen, if you kill them a little bit at a time, they only feel the little pinpricks. They don't feel the total pain, and that's my guess as to what's going to happen. And this stuff could play out a little bit next year, the year after. But they talk about $4 trillion. There's supposedly $1.2 trillion automatic and sequestered cuts. That was the super committee last year that got kicked down the road. So $1.2 trillion automatic. There are supposed to be defense cuts in there. There'll be no defense cuts unless they want to take out veterans' benefits. Those are the only defense cuts that'll come. And if they want to kill a weapons program, they'll substitute with another weapons program. You know what the military wants, what the Lockheed Martins and Boeings want, they're going to get. So if they don't get Brand X, they'll get Brand Y. Weapon X, they'll get Weapon Y. It'll all come out the same in the wash for them. The appropriations of these companies will pretty much be the same. They'll keep going up. They'll keep making ungodly amounts of money. The dirty defense game, they shouldn't call it defense. In World War II, we gave this department the right name. It was called the War Department in World War II. And then the war ended and it was called the Defense Department. But the war's never ended. They literally never ended. To this day, from the day peace was declared in August of 1945, proxy wars, overseas wars, internal wars, the wars never ended. So we should call the department the War Department. Homeland Security shouldn't be that. It should be Homeland Repression. That's what it is.
Well, the wars can't end because they need that to fund their whole machine. You're convincing me that we have to have a third party, and we have to win an election, and we have to have an honest candidate, and we have to make sure he or she has his or her own bodyguard. Because it seems to me you probably get up there, you get to be president, and then they take you in a little room, and then they say, you know, we have your wife and kids here. So you're going to... This is the way it is.
Well, this is the way it is. The Kennedy lesson was never forgotten by succeeding presidents. Kennedy had a mind of his own. He wasn't perfect, nowhere near perfect, but he wanted to do some things that aren't even discussed today by U.S. presidents. I mean, if we only had a Jack Kennedy doing the same kind of things, but we know what happened to him. He tried to do a few important things the right way, so they killed him. They killed him. So, you know, Obama is really nothing more than a puppet. George Bush is a puppet. The power structure runs the country. They decide what is and what isn't. You know, whatever Wall Street wants, it gets. Whatever the Pentagon wants, it gets. Whatever the warmongers, the big and small contractors want, they get. All the other corporations, they get. And the president just gets his lines, and he stands up in front of a teleprompter and reads them. I mean,
but
that doesn't let him off the hook for me, Ellen.
Yeah, they get it because of the funding, though. If we could get back the funding, I think maybe arguably. I mean, what if you had a president who actually, well, like Roosevelt, had the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, which was not subject to approval by Congress. They just did it. They took this bank, which wasn't even a bank. It was just a financial institution, and they used it to fund everything in sight. And it was run by Jesse Jones, who happened to be brilliant and a sort of brilliant maverick sort of guy. And he funded, you know, they did all these marvelous things, and nobody could override it because, of course, the president was with him. The president gave him a total green light, and it wasn't subject to censoring by Congress. So, and the same thing in Brazil, President Lula at the beginning of like 2002 when he got elected, he took this existing development bank, the BNDES, and made it much bigger and just funded all sorts of anything good for the economy, no derivatives, etc., but real productive things, and it totally turned the economy around. So if you could get a president who had his own bank, who could fund all good things. I think maybe, arguably, the economy could be turned around in the same way. I don't know why, but I have visions of good things happening.
Oh, it could be turned around if we only had people doing the right thing. I remember William Blum, when I read his book, Rogue State, and I've got two editions of his book. It's a marvelous book. It was written a number of years ago, but it goes back over the history of CIA crime and a whole lot more. It's a very voluminous book. It's a marvelous book. You can get it in paperback. Anybody who hasn't read it, I absolutely recommend it. I mean, it really shows you what's been going on in this country for so many years. And I remember, not in the book, I think he wrote separately, or maybe it wasn't the book, but he wrote that he wondered if he ever, if in his dreams or whatever, he could ever become president of the country. And he went on and said, on day one I do ABC, and on day two I do a DEF, and on day three I do a GHI, and on day four I'd be assassinated.
Well, you wonder, but it's still, I can just see this sort of anthill type thing. You put your leader up and that one gets knocked down, and so put another one up and another. I mean, that's the way they fight wars, right? Somebody, where did I read this recently, that we're not really here to live a long life and die in a nursing home. We're really here to die nobly. And we're all, that assumes, of course, I suppose, something like reincarnation or that you go somewhere else later, but it's sort of like ants or like, you know, we're in a war. That it's sort of a quiet war. They make it, they keep the TVs on so nobody really notices, but we really have to have some heroes here that are willing to go up there and get taken out.
Well, I agree, Ellen. I simply can't imagine. I'm getting up in years. I'm retired. Most people my age are relaxing, taking life easy. You know, you had a working lifetime, whatever you did. And, you know, you reach a certain age and you decide you retire, whatever age that is. And most people relax. They go fishing or they play golf or something or other. And I simply couldn't imagine that. I retired in the end of 1999 at age 65. I simply couldn't imagine doing those things. They just didn't cross my mind. And I wasn't writing then. I never even had a home computer then. I didn't get one until age 70. And I decided I wanted to use my time doing a lot more of that. I never had enough time to spend on before, and that was reading. And I literally began reading 3-4 books every week. I bought most of them used, and sometimes you get lucky and you get a very, very good value. And I literally would buy them a dozen or as many as 2 dozen at one time. I'd get boxes delivered to me full of books, and I'd work them down pretty quickly and buy another box full of books. And I did this for a number of years, and I didn't have enough bookshelves. I had to get more bookshelves to hold them. And now my proudest possession is this library of absolutely marvelous books. Every one I read wasn't a winner. I made mistakes in some of them, but most of the ones by far were marvelous books that I would recommend to everyone. And when I found a good author, I wanted to read everything that person wrote, and I came close. I mean, I'd read a dozen books by one author. Some of them were very challenging. I mean, they wrote so many I couldn't read them all. James Petras, who comes on this program, I've read a dozen of his books. They're marvelous. They're all marvelous. He's written, I think, 68, or maybe it's up to 70 now. It may have even passed 70. I haven't read them all.
You need a Kindle, you know.
I'm sorry, Ellen?
You need a Kindle.
Yeah.
But that makes it way too easy to buy. You can impulse buy with a click. You know, well, anywhere in the world, and the book will arrive on your Kindle. The other cool thing about
Kindle. You mean arrive online?
Yeah, well, your Kindle, it's just a little flat screen that you carry around with you and fits in your purse.
Oh, like well, I'm so used to traditional books, and when I read something, it's actually a lot easier to read something online because you can adjust the font size to your comfort level. When you buy a book, you get it in the way it's printed, And my publisher
Kimberly can adjust. Yeah.
Well, I think a lot of publishers print in smaller print. That's probably very easy for younger people. And when you get up in years like I am, the small print isn't quite as easy to handle. But if you have the book online, Clarity Press, my publisher, the two books of mine that they published, the new one, Banker Occupation, you can either buy the hard copy or you can buy it online. And when I finish reading a book, I like to have it on my shelf. But I guess that's the way I've always felt. That's the way I grew up. There were no computers when I was back in school, and a book was a book. It wasn't an image on a computer or any other screen. It was a book. It had pages you could turn, and that's what I got used to over the years. So that's what I'm comfortable with. So I like to have that finished hard copy when I get finished reading something I like, and I can always go back and have it on my shelf. I can pull it out. What I write is very good to use as a reference source. And your Web of Debt, Ellen, it not only is an extraordinary book, but it's an extraordinary reference source where you can go back into the book and look up vital information and check important things about banking, the good and the bad. So again, it's almost like an encyclopedia of how to do banking right, and it's marvelous. It's very detailed, and it's a treasure. I mean, I simply couldn't imagine giving up that book. And a friend gave me the copy, Ellen, and she said, "You've got to read this book." And I wanted to write something about it when I started reviewing your book. I wanted to write something about it, but it was so big. I said, "Well, it's quite a job to do it all. I think I'm just going to write. I'm going to do a snapshot of the book, or cover a portion of it." And I got into it and I started doing it, and I got so engrossed in what you were writing that, you know, just like Lay's potato chips, I just couldn't stop. I couldn't stop. I think I did 8 reviews on the book.
That was the most extensive review I ever got. That was great. Thank you so much.
I remember Michael Hudson saying to me one time, I told him I wanted to review one of his books, Super Capitalism, I think was the name of it. That was several years ago. And he paid me a wonderful compliment. He said, "If you review my book as well as you did Ellen's, I'll be very, very pleased." Well, I didn't give him 9 reviews. I gave him 1 long review.
I hope he was pleased. Long, but, yeah. Well, thank you. That was a great review.
Yours was a one-off for me, Ellen. Yeah. I never did anything like that before. I stopped reviewing books because I get so busy doing what I'm doing, writing 2 articles a day. To do an extensive book review, which is the way I like to do them, takes an awful lot of time. And there are so many things I want to write about, and I don't have the time to cover them all. So I try to get in as much as I can. Today there were 4 things I wanted to write about. Well, I'm lucky. I'll get 2 done. I can't do all 4 in one day. I'm not Superman, so if I try to do book reviews, that would really slow me down a great deal. But I'd want to say something about a book. And most of all, what I want to do with your book in public banking, this is a marvelous venue to promote the book and tell people about it. And once it's all done and published and you give me a copy, Ellen, we are going to highlight it on this program a number of times. And I look forward to doing that.
Oh, great. Thank you so much. It's done, more or less, but, you know, I'm just hung up on the details. I did Web of Debt, and then I got shot down for different things that I didn't even realize I was vulnerable in. I mean, I cited people that they said, "Oh, no, you can't cite that person." And so now I'm just sort of trigger happy. You know, I'm a little afraid to put it out there because I can already see they're going to say, "Well, there's this or that." You know, I can already see the objections that are... So I'm trying to be complete and make sure of all my sources and that kind of stuff. So that's tricky. Plus my prose, I'm trying to get it all smooth. I just wanted to say one thing about reading books. This is just a personal experience, but yesterday I got a pedicure. I have this one toenail that I can't do myself, so it's either the pedicure or the podiatrist. And so I was in this place, and there's a massage, and you know, you're sitting in the it was a new place, and there's a chair that's a massage chair but they had the TV going quite loud and they had Christmas music going at the same time, so you had these competing musics, and it was like, oh my god, I just wanted to, you know, cover my ears. And so at the end the woman said, "Well, how was that for you?" You know, the woman that took my money. I said, well, it was, you know, it was a lovely pedicure, but I said, you had two sets of music going at the same time, and, you know, it was like very disconcerting or something. And she said, oh, I'm sorry about that. I mean, she didn't even notice. All those people in that room did not notice that there was this huge cacophony going on that was blocking out any, I was trying to read. I was reading my Kindle. It was blocking out any sort of thinking that you could do. But it just seems to me that people are so, there's always a TV going. You can't, even they're putting them on trains and things. You can't even sleep on the train anymore because you've got this TV going all the time. So anyway, what they're plugged into is not what we're plugged into. They're not plugging in where we are. So it's going to be a hard.
Oh, it's a hot fight, and my goodness, yeah. I could check the time. We're just about out of it. Way back after the only real major surgery I had on my knee, and I went to physical therapy, and they had scoundrel media news on during physical therapy, and I said either you turn that off or change the station to something not as vile as what you're hearing, or I'm leaving.
Right.
And I mean, I meant it. I was not going to say I came for physical therapy, not to be lied to by some newscaster. And I literally would have gotten up and walked out and gotten another physical therapist. Well, they turned the station off. I don't know what anybody else minded, but if you go for physical therapy, or if you go for a pedicure, or if you go for anything, you don't go to get blasted by crap you don't want to hear.
Yeah. This is totally a random observation, but
Ellen, we're out of time. A quick final thought.
My mother was in the hospital, and they were wheeling her into surgery, and it was Halloween. And on the wall, they had these skeletons with patient garments on them. Like, they thought that was funny. My mother's 93. I mean, a good thing she didn't notice, but imagine the nightmares you would have going into surgery half-drugged, seeing these draped skeletons with patient, you know, things on.
People show up for work and they leave their brains at home. Oh, my goodness. Ellen, we are plumb out of time. I'll send you an email off air. Oh, it was great having you back on again. We'll be back again next month, unless you're globetrotting again.
Oh, no, I'll be here.
You'll be there.
And I'm getting surgery in February.
Oh, in February. Oh, my goodness.
All right, thanks so much. It was great talking to you.
What a gruesome thought. Oh, goodness. Anyway, I'll email you, and we'll be back tomorrow, same time. Another great program. Please join us. Make it a regular habit.